Hello and welcome to Phoenix Rising, presented by Zwift, the ultimate indoor training app. Fun is fast. Head to Zwift.com. Phoenix Rising is a new video podcast backed by the Phoenix Foundation, where we talk to some of the greatest athletes on the planet about what motivates them, about their mindset, their challenges, and how they rise. It's a look into the minds of those who have pretty much scaled the peak of human physical achievement and what we can take from their lives and their mindset to implement into our own. And that's what it's all about. Now, there's a lot of mystique surrounding our guest for episode 3, from his physical capacity to his training methods up there in Norway to his truly singular focus. I think he's a bit of an outlier when it comes to that. Of course, I'm talking about the man whose 10-year plan paid off in spectacular style in 2021 when he became triathlon world champion and Olympic champion. It is Christian Blumenfeld. The Phoenix Foundation presents the Phoenix Rising Podcast, brought to you by Zwift, the ultimate indoor training app. Fun is fast. Head to Zwift.com. Welcome to another episode of Phoenix Rising. This podcast is all about mental resilience, the approach to elite sport, how you pick yourself up when you fall down, and balance, and all those things that go into elite performance, but are also the life skills that Phoenix looks to assist with in kids. And, well, that's one end of the journey. The other end is when you win an Olympic gold medal, and Christian Blumenfeld has done exactly that in triathlon, and it's been a really interesting journey. Christian, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on Phoenix Rising. And it's really interesting to chat with you because, like I said, you've had a unique journey, but let's take you right back to the beginning. I mean, how did you get into triathlon originally? I think you're a swimmer, right?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up as a swimmer and football player, and I guess I never really learned how to swim properly. Like, I was putting in so much time, but I didn't really get the progress. But in the same time, I was feeling much more, the running was coming much more naturally. So even I was putting in twice a swim every day, I was still a better runner than I were in the pool. So I guess adding on the bike and then starting with triathlon was much more naturally for me. And did my first one back in 2008 when I was 14. And then ever since, that's been my kind of my passion and what I've been doing.
So am I right? I think I've read somewhere that you've said that you were a great trainer when it came to swimming, but you just couldn't put it together in races. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, it's very tricky when you are doing like the competition in the pool, where it's about getting out your potential in 1 minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes, like for 400 freestyle. So I also enjoy kind of the racing style of triathlon more, and I did enjoy the training and the swimming. Like, that's a little bit more like we race. Like, you swim next to someone else and you try to beat them. And so yeah, I would say I was training really hard, but it was just tricky to get it out in 1 minute or so in competition.
I'm not surprised. From what I know of you, and I know you quite well over the years, is that, you know, that you might not have the technique, but you just hit it with like blunt force trauma, like train. Is that what it was like back then, even in your mind?
Yeah, I think because I didn't have the progress I wanted to, then I was thinking, okay, maybe I need to train harder, I need to train more, I need to put in like extra hours, and then but it didn't really work. But I think I got like a lot of benefits from that when it comes to like building the engine, and especially on the bike and the run, that's something that's beneficial. I'm maybe not able to get it out in the water yet, but it's still kind of, I'm close enough. But on the run and the bike, it's where I see that it's I get the benefits from the engine.
Well, how did you get into triathlon? Did someone tap you on the shoulder whilst you were, you know, swimming your seventh session of the day and say, hey man, what do you think about doing this instead? Or did you just naturally progress over to that? And did you see immediate results, like when you came in and started riding a lot and running a lot, that it just took off?
Yeah, so, well, back then, by coincidence, I got a swim coach who did a little bit of triathlon. And then, so he obviously could see that I had a lot of potential in triathlon, especially because my running was pretty good back then. And we did some running with the swimming team. And then a swim coach kind of advised me to give triathlon or open water a try, because they realized that maybe I wouldn't be able to get out my potential in the pool, but I had this kind of huge talent in kind of engine wise. I was really strong and I was never kind of stopping. So they advised me to try something else, like either open water swimming or triathlon. So they gave me like a list of different events, and my local triathlon was one of them. And I turned up, and so I did it quite well. Since I were like the youngest one there, we had to swim a little bit shorter. So I swam like 400 and then a sprint distance for the bike and run. So I managed to keep the gap and won the race. And a few months later, I was contacted by a guy who wanted to start up the national team. So from there on, I was like one of four guys who joined the national team. And it's not because of the standards were so high that we only had four guys, but it was more that he only could find four guys who was willing to start being a triathlete at that time, because it was still kind of a very weird sport for not the daily athlete. Like, so yeah, one of four, and since it's been kind of gradually building on, and it's been good.
Are any of those other three still around? Or who was that? Was that not Gustav and Kasper, was it?
Gustav and Kasper, they came in like the year after, because then we had like a little bigger camp where we were maybe 20 athletes. But Jürgen Gunnarsson, he's still around. It was him and his father, and then it was two more. So, yeah, it's still kind of the same. A lot of the same athletes that we had like from 2010, 2011, were still around.
Think about that. It's quite incredible when you go from like anyone who turns up can be in the national team to like, you know, an all-Norwegian World Triathlon Championship podium, 70.3 world champion in Gustav Iden, I just mentioned, a world champion and Olympic champion in yourself, Christian, and obviously Kasper's had some incredible results as well. It's a crazy decade. That's absolutely mad for me. And I think that one thing that you guys bring, and this is just from an outsider's perspective, is the level of focus day in, day out, and training-wise to just not be distracted by anything at all. It just seems like you guys do an incredible amount of work. What is it that keeps you focused? Because for me, I'm like, I'll try some things, and then I get distracted, and I go to the pub, or then I get distracted, and I get distracted. But like you've got this incredible focus. Did you always have that, or is that something that you've had to continue to work on? And develop is this ability to just continually focus week in, week out?
Yes, I think the key is that kind of in the group, we dare to dream, and we it's fine to say that you want to win the world championship next year. In a lot of other groups, they might be a little bit more like holding back. Like, it would be nice to maybe get a medal. Like, so we all put our goals out there, and by doing so we also have to put in the work to be able to be in a position to win that gold medal. And then when you have, like we have with Gustav and Kasper and also younger athletes coming up, when they put in kind of everything they can, then it's quite naturally to just float along and doing my training kind of world class too, because that makes the kind of the training, the daily training, to feel more like natural. It's not like I'm crazy one who is doing three or four sessions a day, because everyone around me is doing the same thing.
You're all equally mad and you don't talk to anyone else, and so it just feels normal. I understand. I totally understand. You mentioned that, like, you know, saying I want to be world champion next year. I know that you've done this. I know that you've actually done this, because it was here in Australia where we saw these headlines. It was like, mad Norwegian guy says he's going to win the Olympics in 2 years, guarantees victory. And yeah, tell us a story about that.
Yeah, so that was back in 2018 when I had like, it was a Norwegian journalist who came along on a training camp before the Gold Coast Grand Final, and then it was kind of pre-Olympics, and they asked like what our ambition were, and all of us said like we would win the gold medal, and I even said like, I guarantee you I will win it. So that became like the headline. But it even started way before that. Like today before the games in Tokyo, I got like this notification 9 years back from a newspaper from my town where I said like the goal was to win the Olympic gold in 2020. And that was like 9 years on the day. So it's been kind of something we've been working towards for 10 years. And we, like when I was a young kid, the first thing I said to Arel when he asked me like what I wanted to achieve, I said like I wanted to win the gold medal in triathlon. And by saying that early, it's kind of put the standard for what we need to do in training.
So, I mean, you obviously put yourself under a lot of pressure when you say things like that, whether it's, I mean, in the group is one thing, but in the media is a separate thing. But did you feel like you were put under pressure by saying things like that, or did you allow it to just continually drag you up and you just turn that into motivation? And if you did, how did you avoid the pressure of saying, I guarantee I'm going to do this, and then working towards it for 10 years and then waking up on the morning of and knowing you've got to deliver on that? Or be disappointed.
I think it's I'm just answering honest on my goals. Like when I work towards a gold medal, like why should it be so dangerous saying that I want to win the race? So it's more like I find it tricky to go back and say like, nah, fifth place is good enough. Like when that's not what I'm working for. Like. I do dream about winning the race, and that's what I'm working towards. And I think it's not a failure to kind of fail in the race. Of course, like you haven't achieved what you're working towards, but it's just a part of the journey. So it's been so many races where I've gone in and tried to win it, but then finishing second or third or 52nd, you know, it's just a part of the journey. But I think it's okay to dream about winning races and giving your best.
That's a really interesting one, because my follow-up question was going to be like, say you crossed in, you got the silver medal, and I know that you've finished on the podium a massive number of times before you won in Lausanne eventually at the end of 2019. So you've been through this, but say you cross the line in Tokyo after 10 years and you win the silver, which by anyone's standards is a fantastic effort. What's your first thought? Like, what is your first thought in your head? Do you go, yes, I won the silver medal? Or do you go, I missed out on the gold medal?
I think I would be thinking, I came away with something. Like the days before the race, I was thinking, I really do need to win that gold medal. If not, podium is sort of, it's not happy, but it's not extremely disappointed either. But everything else would be like a dark month, like coming up afterwards, because I would be so disappointed. So I think it would be a bittersweet with that medal, because it was so much about winning the race.
Because you've built up to this now, and I've been doing a few podcasts with different athletes who have either gone to the Olympics and done incredibly well, won a gold medal, or maybe they've fallen short, and that no matter what happens, they all seem to have fallen into a bit of a hole after, because you build up and you build up and you build up and you build up, and your build up was 10 years. So, but you raced straight away after, pretty much. You just kept racing. So I know you had a week off eventually after Super League Triathlon, but did you have any, after this high of achieving it, did you have a low point where you're like, well, what do I do now? I've done it. Or did you just keep pushing forward? How did you deal with that?
Well, I had so many goals afterwards. Like, I wanted to win Hawaii same year. So kind of straight after the games, I jumped on a TT bike, trying to qualify for Hawaii before I got the wild card. Then I switched the focus towards Edmonton and the grand final, trying to take the world championship. And then after that, trying to take the St. George world championship. So I've always had kind of the new focus coming up after the race. So what's been tough for me is kind of having to do all my daily training, but it's not like I had kind of a week off really before, after Malibu. So it's been kind of, the training has been ongoing every week. And on top of that, doing all of the kind of extra media stuff and photo sessions and filming around and trying to organize that. So I felt it was really good to just have 1 week where I didn't do anything at all other than sleeping and maybe going to the store to buy some food. Like putting kind of turning the day off and just staying, doing nothing.
What does that look like? I'm imagining you lying in bed, like ice cream tub on your chest, just watching Netflix. Was this the vibe? And did you have to stop yourself from going for a run? Like, did you have to kind of muscle memory go, no, I'm putting it away?
No, that was just naturally. I felt like it was something I just needed to recharge properly. So it was more like waking up, drinking coffee, being on the computer, just watching Netflix and drinking coffee again, waiting until lunch, and then maybe having a short sleep midday again, and then waiting until the evening is coming.
Yeah, it's like you got to stop talking to me like that. I'm locked down at home with two kids and doing homeschooling. That just sounds like a dream to me. So I guess the takeaway from this though is like, you know, continual goal setting. And like you said, you went after the Olympics, you went and won the World Championships in Edmonton. And then, you know, you were in a good position at the 70.3 Worlds before you had a mechanical. And then you obviously you go and race Super League and do it like you do. And now you obviously in another training block heading up to another Ironman, which would be, you know, your first Ironman, right?
Yeah, that's right. So now,
am I right?
I'm 1 week in now on my camp here in Sierra Nevada. I'm going to stay here for 5 weeks before flying over to Cozumel, Mexico for 2 weeks on the island before the race. So I just did like 2 days yesterday and the day before of some solid Ironman race pace sessions. So it will be interesting to see what I'm capable to do. I think I have always thought that I can do it better than the ones who's doing it at the moment. So yeah, we will see what I can do on the first time out. It's going to be tricky with kind of the heat as well, because if I blow up in the race, you really do blow up in the race. So, but in the same time, I want to go fast. So to find that kind of fine line there, where if it goes wrong, I can still finish the race the last hour without having to walk.
So, and I've heard you say that before, that you've always thought that you can do Ironman better than those who are doing it now. And these are guys like that we're talking about, like a Jan Frodeno or a Sanders or a Keenley or whatever. The guys have been doing it for 10 years and they hear that obviously and they're like, oh yeah, we'll come and do one. Right? But why? Why can you do it better than those who are doing it now? What is it? Is it the data? Is it your physiology? Is it your training? What is it?
I just think it's like I don't know, my engine and kind of the training we do, the high volume and maybe the extreme self-belief that, of course we can do it.
Well, I think that's a big part of it, right? So you're going to go through those up and downs in a race, but coming in with that quiet self-assurance that has delivered you a world championship and an Olympic medal, gold medal in the same year, I mean, that's got to be a big part of it. So, and we've talked a lot about your successes, but what's your lowest point? What was your lowest point in your career? Like, was there a regret or was there something that went wrong? Or was there something that when you think about the lowest point, what springs to mind first?
Both, maybe my beginning of 2019 season was quite kind of low, where like I went to Thailand with some virus and I maybe did a little bit too much training in the heat there. And I couldn't recognize my own kind of legs for 3 or 4 months afterwards. like nothing. We're working on the body, like doing 3 sessions a day, and yeah, just knowing that. For example, when I turned up to the first World Series race in Abu Dhabi, and I was kind of having, I knew that I was in big trouble before the race, and I was thinking, okay, maybe if I can make it within top 20, I should be happy because my legs is really fucked at the moment. So that was quite a rough month when, yeah, I still had to do the training and kind of trying to find out what was wrong. And but again, it made the kind of the enjoying feel much more. It was much more enjoyable when I then came back and managed to take Lausanne and then race well in Super League again after in the end of that, in the end of 2019. But the spring there was really rough.
Because I always want to take that those moments, because everyone experiences that, right? So in elite sport you do, but you know, if you're just doing local age groups or you're participating in sport as you're a kid or whatever, you have moments where it just all falls apart. So, and everyone has a different mental process, right? So, and then you've arrived at a place where you have, as you said, extreme self-belief, and that extreme self-belief combined with all of your physiological markers and training and everything else has delivered you the most successful year of any triathlete in 2021 amid so many headwinds. So what's your mental process look like? When do you get out, when you get out of a hole like that? Is it just a step-by-step, do the next training session, try and hit a mark, just keep slowly clawing away out? Or do you have mantras, or do you meditate? Or what is it that you do to get your mind in order so that your body follows in times like that?
I think like first you need to recognize that, okay, it's something wrong with your body, and kind of maybe take a step back. And then... So we did that, had like some meetings there where we just realized, okay, I'm like locally overtrained in my muscles and need to slow down a bit. So that's what I did. I had like a few weeks there where I was just doing my own training, just everything in my own pace, measuring lactate on all these training to make sure that I didn't go too hard on anything. And just letting naturally the body to recover.
So from there, I mean, that's a test and learn thing, isn't it? So, and I know that you guys, and we've spoken with Olaf, who kind of heads up your team, the data is so important. And I think a lot of your self-belief comes from that, where you know the numbers that you have are going to deliver you race wins. And that focus on data, and it's probably like, I imagine it's like a self-reassuring cycle where you're like, okay, I train hard, I get the numbers, I know I'm going to do well, I'm motivated to train hard, I get the numbers, I know I'm going to do well. Is that how it feels?
Well, the data can go both ways. Like so many times I've been in the lab and doing all-time high testings and then coming to a race and then just something went wrong and kind of I'm not getting the results that I'm expecting to get. But then you kind of start learning to see like how am I, what's my level in training, and then what kind of results do I get out of that in a competition, and then maybe in the next race I can see like how is my lactate responding in the training, how am I feeling, and then how am I performing in the race. So it's about kind of taking the numbers as the numbers, and then getting the experience to know how to perform in a race.
It's fun. It feels like this last 12 months for you, or no, I'll go back to even the last 2 years, say from the end of 2019 to now, is like the payoff period for you of 10 years of hard grafting and building and building and building and building. And now you're like, bang, won this, bang, I've done this, bang, I've done this. Like you just keep going now and you're in this absolute peak moment. So if you could go back now to say yourself when you were 10 or 15 or 20 even, and say, you know, and give yourself advice, I mean, what would you tell yourself? I mean, would it just be to trust the process and keep pushing forward? I mean, what would the advice be to young Christian?
Not necessarily trust the process, because if the process is wrong, I think it's good to be kind of set yourself into your training. Like kind of you should be kind of studying your own sport. So as a young athlete, I think you should always ask questions to the coach, like, why are we doing this in the training? Trying to get an understanding for why. And if you know why, then it's easier to push hard when it's tough. And it's easier to maybe hold back on easy training when you're supposed to hold back. So always be interested in the training, because the more you know as an athlete, the more you understand, the better it is to do the decisions every session to make yourself better. And also maybe Google some about training to challenge your coaches a bit as well, like because they doesn't know everything. So just try to get the information where you can and try to make kind of a picture of how we can use it.
I mean, you're a real student of this, and I know that, because every time we've interviewed each other, well, I've interviewed you, you don't care about what I'm doing. You don't ask me any questions. That's fine. Don't worry about it. When I've interviewed you, you know, I say, okay, Christian, what do you do outside of triathlon? And you go, oh, not this again, not this question. And then... And you tell me about this time that you had to write three things that you three of your hobbies, right, for a magazine or whatever, and you just had to end up writing swim, bike, and run. And then the next time I interviewed you, you said, "Oh, well, I've got a new hobby. I got something outside of triathlon." And I'm like, "Awesome, mate. What is it?" I'm thinking like it could be, you know, knitting, or maybe just, I don't know, just drawing or something. And he said, "I'm making videos of my training." I'm like, that's not it, man. Come on, man. So I guess you're not, and balance is important, right, for any teenager coming up to kind of like, you know, not get too involved, but you're not the poster child for that idea. So yeah, you're very focused. So how do you stay fresh mentally? And tell me, have you got any new ones? Have you got any new hobbies? Give me something.
No, not really. But like, I think the way you can go stay fresh mentally is like going for a long ride, like either with some friends, if that's kind of the stimuli you want, or you can go just by yourself and kind of have your own, with your own thoughts, and just enjoying the nature. Like if I really feel like I need to recharge my battery, I might go for a mountain run at home. So just try to mix it up a little bit. That do a little. You can still do the training, but do it a little bit different wise.
Do you have any regrets of your career? I mean, obviously you can look back at 2019 and go, "I shouldn't have done that." But is there any specific decision that you made where you just go, "Oh, what was I thinking there?" Is there anything that, or you just put all that away and only work on what's happening today?
I think it's important to look at it as experience. And like, I've done a lot of mistakes up throughout the years, but it's making me to what I am today. And it's not like I'm regretting, but it's kind of maybe looking back and kind of laughing a little bit of all the mistakes I've done. But it's just kind of giving me the experience that I have today.
Yeah, I really like this concept that it runs through all your answers, which is more like, you know, there's no failure in sport. There's only the journey. There's only the journey as we move forward, and you have good moments and otherwise, and there's no regrets. I think that's really important for anyone who, you know, if you're a kid listening to this or whatever. So it's so easy to dwell on your errors. Like, I can still remember all the big mistakes I made in my sporting career, and I just go, "Oh, what was I doing?"
Yeah,
part of the journey.
Like when I was a young kid, like I got my first stress fracture in 2013, I think, and started running too early, and kind of it just so held me back. Instead of for 2 months, I was out for 9 months for running. But it's nothing that I should be regretting on now. It's more experience I got, and it makes sure that when I get an injury now, I'm taking it 100% serious. I do the build-up of training and recovery, and then takes the time to come back 100%. So even though I lost some months of training or running back then, I still have the experience of knowing what I should do now. And actually last year I got this leg injury that told me out of the Daytona race. And maybe with the experience I got from when I was a junior, I managed to give myself the time to build it up, and ending up kind of coming out of the spring and winter season of training in maybe my best running shape ever.
Yeah, that's always a trap, isn't it? If you're younger, you don't think long term, and so you might miss Daytona, but then you go and pick up, you know, Tokyo, and you go pick up Edmonton. But when you're 15, you just want to do whatever's the next thing, and I totally understand. So that's, I hope that's some good advice for anyone out there who's listening and trying to rush themselves back. And now we're in an interesting position, because next year there will be two world championships, and sandwiched in between is going to be the sub-7, sub-8 project, and that's something that you're doing alongside Phoenix. And you're going to be, for anyone who doesn't know, you're going to be aiming to be the first person ever to go under 7 hours for an iron distance race. And we don't really call it that because that's an Ironman thing. It's not an Ironman event, but for the full distance triathlon. So break this down. You've got to swim at Olympic open water medal pace for the 10K swimmers. You've got to do your 3.8Ks at that pace. Then you've got to ride faster than the quickest Tour de France stage ever recorded. And then you've got to run a quicker marathon than anyone's ever run on a full distance triathlon in 40 years. And I can tell just from looking at your face that you are supremely confident that you will be able to do that, deliver it, and beat Alistair Brownlee, the dual Olympic gold, in the process.
Yeah, it's going to be a really cool challenge. And like a lot of athletes now, maybe feel the need of doing something kind of differently the post-Olympic year. And I have the chance, but it's still swim, bike, run. It's just the longer stuff. So that's going to be really, really cool. And I just kind of started the process now towards Cozumel and getting the experience there. Because it will be kind of, because I think it's something like to learn how slow you need to run, like in the arm and after the bike, because it's so naturally when we're training for sub-3 minute pace to just go out for maybe 3:25 in the beginning. So to be able to get an understanding for why I need to run as slow as they do now in Ironman. It's probably an experience. So it's going to be good.
Does your data say that you have to run that slow? I mean, do you think you could run 3:25 pace for 42 kilometers?
I think if I do the training well, it should be possible, yeah. So if I can get kind of my race pace up to my aerobic threshold, then it should be possible, I think. And also on the bike, if I can get the deficiency up there and also improving my carbohydrate intake, I think it should be possible to ride faster as well. And that is without drafting. So if you put in drafting on top of that, yeah. But again, it's going to be like a year of learning and trying and trying to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, how are you coming along with, you know, obviously we don't have the rules that a standard distance race would have, so you can change things around your wetsuit, you can change things around your bike and your shoes and your helmet and the way you draft and your tactics and nutrition and everything. So have you been speaking with your sponsors around developing gear or technology for this specifically?
Yeah, well, I guess we will end up with following the equipment rules of Ironman, because if not, we can just come there on kind of the bikes we're all laying down and having kind of riding in an egg, because then it would be very, very easy to do the record. So I guess we will have to stay with Ironman rules for swim, bike, and run. But pacing wise, it's more kind of the thing that will make the difference.
Okay, so you obviously know something I don't know, because we don't have those. So if you wanted to wear a 5mm or 8mm wetsuit, you can, as far as I know. If you want to stay within the rules, you can do that as well, but Alistair might not necessarily want to do that. Are you willing to let him have that advantage?
Well, I think he will. Like, I think we need to find some rules for the equipment between us, because if not, I can start coming there with fins and pedals, and then people will.
No, whoa. There's a limit. There's a limit.
There's a limit. So we need to
put wetsuit width. Wetsuit thickness, yes. Bikes, you know, I mean, obviously kind of a motor, but, you know, there's some leeway there. And shoes, you could do something there specifically as well. But, yeah, I don't think if you turn up on a motorbike with fins on, and then we might have a problem. Yes.
So I think we need to have some kind of rules to just define the what's okay and not. And then around those rules, we can kind of try to think how we can make advantage of the equipment. So it's still more to do with the bike, for example, within the Ironman rules. So we are looking at stuff like that to get the fastest bike possible. But still, I want to be able to use the equipment in St. George and on Hawaii afterwards.
Oh, well, and then that, you know, obviously that further legitimizes what we're doing. But as you said, and you're right, and we're all agreed that the bike is where the bulk of the time can be made up, because obviously you have a pacemaking group of 10 split across swim, bike and run that you can use however you would like to. I think that everyone's going to move towards having more people on the bike, because obviously that's the bulk of a full distance triathlon, or any triathlon really is on the bike. How is your pacemaking team coming together? Is there anyone that you can give us at this stage that you've locked in or that you're in discussions with about joining your pacemaking team?
Yeah, so I guess it's going to end up in like one swimmer, one runner, or maybe two swimmers and one runner, and then rest on the bike. So at the moment, I have kind of a swimmer, Jürgen, the guy who were the national team from the beginning doing the swim. He's a pretty good swimmer, and I will probably be struggling to stay on his feet. So he is good enough there. And then Gustav, he can run a 220 marathon every day a week. So he has said he's been willing to do the run. But then the bike is where it's very tricky to find pacers, especially because of the level that's required on the bike is so high. Like, it's so many runners who can do 220 on the marathon, but it's very few riders who can be able to produce like 400 watts for such a long period of time, because you basically need to take a world-class cyclist and then maybe train him to do the TT riding as well.
So would you have your cyclists doing longer stints? Because obviously we're going to an oval, so it's possible for your riders to swap in and out. Do you want to limit that amount? Or because obviously the more that you can do short stints with the riders, the more riders there are that can do that kind of power, but you have to swap them in and out.
Yeah. So it's a 5K loop, I think, in Germany. So we're not sure whether like the guys who is kind of having a break from working should either just stay in the group and kind of tributing to making the group being a little bit larger, or if we should have like six riders working in front of me, and then we have one or two who is off the track and kind of trying to recover as much as possible. But I think kind of for the rhythm in the group, it's good to maybe have like one pacing line instead of having kind of chain gang just rotating all the time. So I think it's better to maybe do like 3 to 5 minutes maybe with the guy who's up front, and then they change, because that makes it a little bit easier for me mentally as well when it's not too much happening around me.
Understood. So is there anyone on the bike that you're aiming at as a pacemaker, or is it just it's a very small group and you haven't worked it out yet?
We haven't worked it out yet, and also it comes down to the budget as well. Like, it's not easy to get the world-class riders turning up for free either, so we will have to see what we can do there.
So I know you mentioned when we spoke probably 6 months ago is that perhaps you could run a competition on, say, Zwift or something that would buy in, and then you could have like a competition to see for a place on your pacemaking team. But say the person would have to be able to hold 400 watts and have it all, and then, you know, you could choose. Is that still something that's on the cards? Yeah. Could we do that?
Yeah, I think that's the easiest way to do it, because then you can get some really strong cyclists. And we actually have a meeting with Swift now in just over an hour, and trying to kind of see what they're up for, because they have such a big platform with so many great riders, not just professionals, but you have the ones who's maybe TT specialist, who's very keen to do like an hour or 2 hours of very high power, and also they have a lot of data on them. They know their weight, they know their how tall they are, and they can kind of help us find the best athletes to draft from. So yeah, I think that could be an option. A little bit like the way they did with the Swift Academy racing, where they got the amateur competition, and you could win in the end a slot for a pro riding team.
If there's a Swift cyclist out here listening to this right now, and they're thinking, "Gee, I could be a part of that," would it be 400 watts? Like, I mean, what would you be asking of an athlete, do you think, in your head, for them to be able to qualify to put themselves up for selection?
I guess it's going to be around 400, like for 1 hour power. In neighborhood of that, and also it's probably more advantage to be bigger than smaller, because we would rather have athletes with who's heavier and having a higher power number than having the climbers. Like in the Swift world, it's very often beneficial to be light, because everything is divided on weight per kg. But for this, I think we're more looking at just the raw power data.
So I'm only 265, but I'm very fat. Is that cool?
Yeah. It's, as long as you can do like 310. Can you?
No,
I mean 410.
How long have I got? But I can only do 265.
Okay.
That's it. 265 watts, that's it. But I'm very heavy. Does that doesn't help you, does it?
Oh, no. It's not a downhill. It's not like it's a big advantage to be heavy, but it makes it easier to get the powers up.
Yeah, not for me. Doesn't help me at all. Doesn't help me even a little bit. What do you love about Zwift? I mean, you know, obviously we're coming on board with us. You know, it's an incredible platform, and I know that you're an absolute data lover, and so that must be really handy, especially considering that it's not always, you know, beautiful sunny days in Bergen.
Yeah, I think it's important to go out in the rain once in a while too. But the great thing with the Swift is that it makes it so much more enjoyable being on the turbo. And being on the turbo is very efficient for the training. So you can do kind of a session in there, and you can get so much more out of your threshold session by being on Swift. And also kind of the community they have there in now in with all the kind of the groups, you can kind of chat with everyone you're riding with, and kind of feel like, even though you're riding by yourself in your basement or whatever, you can still feel like you're out riding with your mates from Spain and France and all around the world. So and also I think you feel that you are part of something more than just riding for yourself.
I think that if you ended up with a bunch of pacemakers who'd come to you via Zwift, or even one or two, or even if you didn't have any that came to you via Zwift, Zwift would be a very good platform to use to train with them and to communicate with them. Would that be something you would consider?
Yeah, for sure. Like to find a way where we can kind of practice the kind of the power output from being kind of in the front to stay behind and kind of get a little bit more experience of how we can do the pacing. Of course, it's not going to be 100% real as it is outside, so it will be important to train it outside as well, but just to kind of get to know them and to see the level is going to be important.
Who will win the sub 8, do you think? We've got Lucy Charles Barclay up against Nicholas Spierig. Obviously, they're both in stellar form, or they have been in this year. It's hard to pick. I mean, what do you think?
Well, it isn't really hard to pick after watching St. George. I think Lucy is the big favorite there for sure.
Can you are you writing Nicola off completely though? I mean, at this stage, she'll be 40 years of age when she does this race.
I do believe Lucy is the favorite. Yeah,
that's all you're going to say about that. She has won just about everything she's put her mind to over the past 12 months or so, and she's done plenty, as have you. Mate, thank you so much for your time here on the podcast. Some really interesting insights into the mindset of a champion and also what's coming up for you. We haven't seen you in Kona this past weekend, which is a bit of a bummer, but we will see you no doubt. I mean, if you're going to win the world championship, you want to win it in Kona, right? I mean, you're probably going to do Utah, but don't you want to win it in Kona first?
No, I want to win it in St. George first and then Hawaii afterwards. It's sort of cool to be the only one who has won the Ironman World Championship outside of Kona. But of course, it's something iconical. It's special with Hawaii. That's some of the first thing I was watching of triathlon. Like when I started Googling or YouTubing triathlon more than 10 years ago, it was like either the Olympics from Beijing that I didn't watch back then live, but I was watching it on YouTube, and then it was Hawaii motivation videos. So it's something special with the lava.
Yes, I mean, yes, there's probably an asterisk against it winning in Utah, but it's all good when you just do both. That's a very Christian Blumenfeld answer, you know. We'll just win both, so what's the problem? We'll just win both.
Yeah. You want both.
Easy. Easy. KB, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the next training block coming up to Cozumel. We're really interested to see how you go there. Try not to run too quickly out of T2, mate, unless you can keep it up all the way for the 42, which I believe in you that you can do.
Yeah, I think so. The last half marathon would be important. Hold a little bit back and then smash the last. That's my goal.
You're not very good at holding a little bit back, so we'll see how you actually go when it comes down to it. Thanks for your time, mate. Go and train, and we'll see you soon here on Phoenix Rising.
Thanks, buddy.